This is 9/11 Freefall.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of 9/11 Freefall. My name is Andy Steele, and I am the host. Well, tonight's going to be a good one. The interview is with journalist, author, filmmaker, and show host Christina Borgeson. She was once in the corporate media, and she's experienced the tight control of it firsthand. She'll be talking about that, and of course about 9/11 as well. That's coming your way in just a moment.
He's in the lobby and the third explosion, the whole lobby collapsed on us.
Is that a secondary explosion?
Yes, it was.
Floor by floor, it started popping out.
It was like as if they had detonated. They were planned to take down a building. Boom, 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 boom.
We have explosive demolition at not only the Twin Towers, but also Building 7.
For the third time today, it's reminiscent of those pictures we've all seen too much on television before when a building was deliberately destroyed by well-placed dynamite to knock it down.
You want to call your mother or something?
It's just a matter of time. That's all it is. It's a matter of time and the persistence of those who continue to adhere to it and push for it. And that's what we're doing.
Tune in to 9/11 Freefall, a show about 9/11 truth, 9/11 science, and the activists and scholars who are blowing the lid off the crime of the century. You can download episodes at 911freefall.com.
The views expressed on this show by guests and the hosts on issues outside of the 9/11 controlled demolition evidence are the opinions of those individuals alone and do not necessarily reflect those of architects and engineers for 9/11 truth.
Christina Borgeson is a freelance journalist. She's been a reporter and producer with CBS and CNN. She's edited books such as Into the Buzzsaw, Leading Journalists Expose the Myth of a Free Press, and Feet to the Fire, The Media After 9/11, Top Journalists Speak Out. And she wrote a movie about the investigation into TWA Flight 800, titled that same name, TWA Flight 800. She currently co-hosts a podcast called Whistleblower Newsroom. If you haven't heard of the show, we'll be letting you know how to find it and get caught up with all their great episodes. And we'll be learning more about her efforts for truth and justice. Many years now and a lot of great work happening. So, Christina, thank you for coming on 9/11 Freefall today.
My pleasure.
So this is going to be a big one today. I know all our supporters are listening in and a lot of fans of your work, people who listen to you all the time, and they said, I have to have you on to the show. So we're giving the people what they want today. So in case people are new, you know, I'm always aware that some people may be waking up to the way the world really is for the first time and coming across this podcast and may not know who some of these people are yet. Tell us more about yourself, beginning with what inspired you to get into journalism in the first place.
Well, you know, I'm a curious person. I love people. I love stories. And I think it's almost like a calling. It is a calling for me. I could never imagine myself doing anything else, you know. And I was reared in Haiti under Papa Doc, you know, the bloody dictator. And, you know, journalism there was very cautious, to say the least. And, you know, if you were an enemy of Papa Doc's, he would not only take you out, he'd take out your whole family. So I really thought I had died and gone to heaven when I was accepted at the Columbia School of Journalism. And then I thought the same thing had happened again when I went to work at CBS in their documentary film unit. And the first thing they asked me to do was to work on a run-up of Harvest of Shame, CBS's signature documentary with Edward R. Murrow about migrant farm workers. And I, during the course of doing the run-up, the follow-up show to that, I busted a three-state undocumented worker smuggling ring. This very brutal crew boss who was bringing people in and basically holding them in peonage won an Emmy for that, was nominated for an Emmy the next year for a show I did on Fidel Castro, a biography, and then my whole world blew up when I was assigned to look into the crash of TWA Flight 800. And it was really weird because the way I even found out that the plane crashed was that I had gone home early from work. I was exhausted. I had just finished that Fidel show. And I was taking a nap, and my phone rang, and my son was on a plane to Paris. He was on Air France. But I picked up the phone, and I heard my neighbor say, "Oh, was that your son's plane that just crashed?" And I can't even, to this day, when I think about that moment, I can't explain to you that feeling. It just, I mean, I thought my brain was going to disintegrate. It was the worst and most bizarre feeling in the world. And so anyway, the next day I was assigned to look into the crash, and my son's plane was 5 minutes behind TWA. TWA was going to Paris, so was my son's plane. That's why my neighbor called. So anyway, I start looking into this thing, and you know, right away, you could tell that a cover-up was in progress. And you know, getting to 9/11. I think I was telling you right before we went on air that I have recently been speaking with David Meiswinkle, who is the president of lawyers for, what is it, the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry. And he filed that petition in the Southern District Court, and the petition, which, you know, he says basically presents extensive scientific and eyewitness evidence that explosives were used to destroy the three World Trade Center buildings. Well, when I read his petition, the hair on the back of my neck went up, because his petition read very, very similarly to an affidavit that my team, I put together with physicist Tom Stalkup. We put together a team of whistleblowers, former members of the government investigation of TWA Flight 800. There were six of them. We put them together, and we did this documentary, and, you know, basically it, the evidence, the forensic evidence shows that explosive ordnance was involved in the explosion of TWA Flight 800. But the way that the cover-up was run on TWA 800 from inside the government agencies, and the involvement of the various government agencies, not just the National Transportation Safety Board, but the FBI, the CIA, the suppression of eyewitness accounts, and so on, that David's petition read exactly like an affidavit detailing all the malfeasance on the part of these government agencies, naming names that my team submitted to the Office of Special Counsel. And the Office of Special Counsel responded, you won't believe this. They said, "Oh, well, even though that's the office that looks over whistleblower complaints, they review whistleblower complaints. And by the way, if they think you have a valid complaint, then they send your complaint to the government agency that you are complaining about to review." Okay? As if they're going to review it with, you know, an unbiased eye. But okay, let's move on from that. But anyway, they came back to us and said, well, they really, you know, they could not do anything with this affidavit because they were not mandated to investigate the contents of the affidavit. And I tell you, I just curled up in a little ball. It took us a long time. We had all these exhibits, just like David's petition. You know, he has 57 exhibits. We had almost 50 exhibits. And the exhibits were very, very similar. You know, the proof of explosives evidence, the suppression of the eyewitness accounts. And so, anyway, when I talked to David, I realized that with 9/11, these government agencies behaved even more egregiously. For example, every incident that involves death and destruction and an airplane, the NTSB has to be involved. Now, if it turns out to be a terrorist act, the FBI steps in, and they run their own investigation. But the NTSB is supposed to do an investigation, too. And the NTSB did not participate in the investigation of the World Trade Center incidents or, you know, the Pentagon. I don't know if they were involved out there in Pennsylvania. But anyway, my point is that there seems to be a playbook. And I remember when I was working on TWA with Tom Stalka, it was very painful for me in some ways because after 9/11 happened, our film aired in 2013, so it happened, you know, our film aired way after our investigation was, you know, it's been going on for 17 years. It's still going on, you know, but it was 17 years at that point that we'd been investigating. And I kept telling Tom, you know, that 9/11, it smells like what we're dealing with here, and this, and he just would not hear it. He just would not hear it. 9/11 is so huge. It's one of the most criminal things I think that's ever been done in human history, and it's not only because of what happened here in our country, but what it was used to trigger, you know, all these various wars and so on and so forth. So it became very, very, very painful for me. I would timidly, when I was asked to comment on 9/11, initially I was quite timid about it, and I would just say, well, you know, there are a lot of questions. There are a lot of questions. And I don't think the questions are being answered. And clearly, you know, the 9/11 Commission was a travesty. I don't think there's any other word for it. And I certainly wish some of the members of it, including Mr. Keene, would come forward and talk about that. You know, I mean, somebody has to break that spell. Somebody, a whistleblower, I mean, there are whistleblowers, obviously, for 9/11. The NIST whistleblower, for example, right? But, you know, somebody has to, more than one somebody, you need a group. I mean, that's why my film was a real shock to the press, because I did not use anybody who was not a first-hand source, who hadn't actually handled the evidence. And so, I mean, obviously we did get attacked. The NTSB held a, you know, they held a press conference to correct the record, okay, after our show came on. After our show aired, they held a press conference to, you know, let people know what the true official record was, tell the press that, and they invited the press in. They would not allow anybody to film or record. You could just write down notes, and they would not allow us, even though they were responding to our documentary, they would not allow us to come to their press conference because they claimed we were not journalists. So, and the 9/11 issue is, it's the biggest nut to crack in terms of, you know, malfeasance and corruption. It truly is. And you know, when I spoke to David, I told him, I said, I'm really concerned about, you know, what's going to happen with the grand jury hearing or what's going to happen after.
Well, the way I look at it is that we live in a society that has a justice system, has all of these rules, and we do have to go through all these actions. We have to go through filing grand jury petitions, suing the FBI, go through every single avenue open to us, because there is no other option at this point. And at the very least, you keep bringing this issue up, reminding the powers that be that this is not going away, letting the supporters know that this is not going away, we're not giving up. My hope is that eventually, as time passes, we keep on raising this issue, there will be new people coming in who are more open to taking this on and acknowledging what really happened that day. And even though it happened a long time ago, it still affects our society, and it would still be a big mind-blowing
thing. Well, I mean, it's the crime that keeps on giving, right? I mean,
exactly.
all these wars that were started in the name of 9/11, some of them, obviously, the Iraq War, the war in Afghanistan, and, you know, and then, you know, the loss of our civil liberties, the Orwellianizing of our society and of the world, you know, because of terrorism. I mean, it was the portal for hell, you know? And I'll tell you why when I say, you know, I'm concerned for David. And obviously, you're absolutely right. Every avenue has to be, you know, exploited. It's just, to me, it's just soul-sucking that they take so much energy from so many people, you know, these like our justice system. It's rigged, and that's what I'm worried about for David, you know. They've delayed, okay? Now that's going on. The foot dragging's going on. And as my friend Mike Levine, who's a veteran DEA agent, Fred Whitehurst, who is a whistleblower. He was the head of the FBI lab at one point when he blew the whistle on the lab's really shoddy practices that were, you know, sending people to jail for no reason. And he said, you know, for the FBI, time is their best friend when it comes to some of these cases that they want to go away. Time is their best friend. And, you know, that's what worries me about 9/11 and all the efforts that are being made. I mean, it's stunning to me that globally, around the world, efforts are being made to get some kind of justice, some kind of accountability, some kind of recognition that something terribly wrong, massively illegal and deadly happened here, and people should be held accountable. It's stunning to me that the 9/11 committee and the American justice system had the hubris to not hold anybody, not one single individual, accountable. It's mind-blowing. You know, it's really mind-blowing.
Well, I think that's what horrifies most people when they first wake up to this, because if this was just a simple question of logic, this case would have been done a long time ago. It's the idea, the first thought that comes into most ordinary people who aren't involved in these institutions like media, government, their idea is that, well, either somebody would have talked, or that there's so many people in government that there's no way something like this would have been covered up. They think of all these individuals and don't really study how institutions work, or think of the psychology of people worried about keeping their job, or just not wanting to go there in their minds. And, you know, after a while of doing this, it makes perfect sense to me how this happens, how the media can be so controlled, and we're going to get into that in this show, and how government institutions, people in them, can just be willing participants in trying to bury any new information that gets presented to them. Like in our case, you know, our main adversary that we constantly bump heads with is NIST, pointing out the flaws in their ridiculous reports on these building, quote-unquote, collapses. It's scary for regular people because you think, you know, you're brought up in this country thinking that, yeah, somebody is looking out for this kind of stuff. You might get a bad president here and there, but, you know, hey, Nixon was well, he wasn't impeached technically, but he was on his way and he resigned. They busted him, so America works, you know? But then you look into this and you see that it doesn't work. And I think that really scares a lot of people, and they don't want to go there in their heads and don't want to acknowledge these frailties in our system.
I'll tell you something. For 9/11, as with TWA and virtually all other like big stories, I mean, because at this point there's so many journalists who have had experiences like very bizarre experiences, some of them while trying to work on a big story, you know, and having, you know, very strange, like in my case, at one point I was going to go shoot a group eyewitness show because I tried to do my this documentary. I was assigned to do a piece on TWA for a show for ABC way back, and after I got fired, basically let go from CBS because the FBI came after me for a little piece of evidence that was sent to me, a little piece of evidence from inside the TWA investigation, the official investigation. After that, I was hired to do a little 10-minute piece that was also brought down by the press before it came out. It was very, very strange. I had barely shot a frame of the show when all of a sudden this piece, and the show, it was actually a pilot for a show that was going to be called Declassified, and it was going to be like an edgier 60 Minutes. These were hardcore investigative pieces. But Oliver Stone was going to be the host. And so they wanted me to do something on TWA. So I didn't want to do it at first because I had recently lost my job at CBS, and I was so shocked. I was so shocked at what had happened to me at CBS. They let me go basically because they were pressured into doing it. So I was just... No, I was actually thinking of getting out of journalism because I was so shocked by it. But anyway, when I was hired to do that second piece, one of the first things that happened was my car was broken into. Very professional job, okay? It was actually my friend's car. We were going to go do a shoot. She was my associate producer, and you know, we were going to go do this group shoot of eyewitnesses, and we go to our car and go to the trunk, and her computer and our TWA, all our TWA documents were taken, everything else, camera, golf clubs, other expensive items, you know, were still there, just her computer and the papers, and the lock was, you know, it was a very professional job. And that kind of thing really frightens, is really frightening. You know, other journalists, what's her, Cheryl Atkins, who was covering, I think she was covering Benghazi. She was doing some work on Benghazi and Fast and Furious. And next thing she knows, she's in bed in the middle of the night and her computer turns on and her computer was scanned, and at one point she was on her computer, and as she was writing, it was being erased. What she was writing was being erased. I mean, Cheryl Atkinson, I'll tell you, there's some bad, evil players in our government agencies. And so 9/11 being such a huge story, and, you know, the cover story, the official narrative being so, I mean, so much rests on that not cracking, okay? And so much criminality was launched on the false narrative that it makes it a terrifying subject for journalists to cover. And the way, what happens with the mainstream journalists, I'll tell you, it, as a matter of fact, it just happened to me recently on my show with a journalist that I, a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist that I interviewed. You have to understand that these journalists, whatever the official source tells them, it's in their DNA practically to accept it as the truth. You do not question that official source. That is your, you know, they're in a position of, they have a title, they have a certain power. They tell you something is, you know, something is black, then it's black. And you do not look to the left or to the right of that. And so what happens with them, I'll tell you, I was doing a show with Dan Rather on his Dan Rather Reports on the run-up to the Iraq War, how it was done, you know, how the propaganda was put together in the Office of Special Plans in the Defense Department by Doug Feith and his little group. And I interviewed this woman, Karen Kwiatkowski, who was sharing office space with those guys and was watching what was going on. She was a colonel. And when I started putting my show together, the senior producer who was reviewing the script was going, "Who are these people? I've never heard of these people." I said, why? Because the mainstream media would never talk to these people. These people were whistleblowers. They were talking about the bogus, you know, all the bogus information that was being fed to the White House and that they were putting out in talking points, coordinated talking points. And she goes, "I've been," and literally is what she said, she says, "I've been to college, I read a lot of newspapers, and I've never heard of any of this." And you know what? I didn't know what to tell her. I couldn't just tell her, "Listen, the reason why is because you don't talk to people who will tell you the truth on these matters. You talk only to the official sources. So you're walking around with an official source paradigm in your headspace. Not the truth, the official source paradigm." So fast forward to a couple weeks ago, I'm interviewing this guy, Pulitzer Prize winner. His name is James Stewart. You know, very, very accomplished journalist, right? And he wrote this book, Deep State. Why, he says? Because he wants to know what exactly triggered the Russiagate, okay, the Russiagate investigation. He wants to know exactly what triggered it. I read his book, and in his book, he says, "Oh, yes, well, this guy, George Papadopoulos, you know, he was the one who was going around saying that, you know, they had dirt on Hillary Clinton. He knew about the emails, or her emails that had been hacked by the Russians." And so I said, "Well," I said, "have you spoken to George Papadopoulos? And what do you think he said?"
"Probably not."
"Exactly." He said, no. He says, "I was just talking," you know, he clearly had only been talking to James Comey and Comey's team, right? And I said, "Well, you should have talked to him, because the information about the emails didn't originate from him. It originated from this, you know, intelligence-connected guy named, professor named Mifsud." And I said, "And by the way, you know, the forensic evidence that was done by Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity including a NSA whistleblower, tech genius, computer genius, Bill Binney, you know, they said that, you know, the forensic evidence shows that the Russians didn't hack the DNC computers, that the information was taken out of there, probably on a thumb drive, because it was done very quickly in a hack. The speed at which the information was extracted indicates that it was taken out and put up, you know, taken out on a thumb drive, not hacked. When I told him that, he said, well, that's not what my book's about. That's not what I said, but your book is about trying to get to the truth of why they started this investigation, and you're making certain assumptions. And he said, look, listen, I only have three more minutes to go. Like, he wanted to get, he could not, it was like he refused to process anything that hadn't been told to him or that contradicted what his official sources said. And that's the pathology. And so that pathology, it's exponentially greater with this story, with the 9/11 story. Exponentially greater. But the journalists have to be confronted. I've spoken to some 9/11 people about this before. When somebody lies about the evidence pertaining to 9/11, these big people, they should take, you know, the leaders, you know, the credible leaders of the 9/11, the architects and engineers in particular, because they deal with the forensic evidence, the pilots, because they know how planes can and can't behave, etc. These people need to bombard the individual journalist, because that's what we did when our whistleblowing film on TWA came out. When it came out, any journalist that lied about the evidence or what happened, or simply misreported because they were ignorant, which was also often the case, we would write to them and correct them. We would write to their boss, then we would talk about it publicly, and boy, that stuff started to dry up like nobody's business, because they don't like to be singled out. They don't like to be singled out. So that's one of the things that, you know, I'd like to see this movement do.
Yeah, we did a campaign calling into C-SPAN a couple of years ago, doing that exact strategy, and it would just ask the question, don't say anything else, and it would put these people right on the spot. And you could really see the control happening. One of them, because the interview on that morning show, a congressman and journalist, and one congressman said, I was told I might get a question about this. And so they're getting prepped. And one of them, I think it was Chris Smith, kind of looks off camera when he gets his question that day. Like someone's acknowledging, okay, give this standard answer. So it's very fascinating when you do boil it down to the individuals and ask them these questions when they're not surrounded by this spongy membrane of television cameras.
Well, that's how they have to be approached. It was funny because after our film came out, and CNN has been one of the worst offenders for TWA, and of course for 9/11 as well, but after our film came out, and clearly Anderson Cooper had seen it, and at some point during some newscast, you know, during his AC 360 or whatever show, at some point he misspoke and talked about TWA being shot down. And boy, I'll tell you, 2 hours later, he was on the air saying he misspoke. He didn't mean to say that. Of course not. TWA was shot down. La, 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 la. He just, you know, he had to go back on that air and backpedal publicly. Okay? That's how big a deal that was. And again, if you do that to these people on an individual basis, because discrediting a reporter, I mean, if a reporter is discredited, what else do they have? If you don't have any credibility, and the only reason Anderson Cooper or any of those guys, you know, the credibility they have really is just that they're, you know, they have a big platform, they have a big official sources on there who come on and say things, and that's their milieu, and because they're big and they're powerful and they're slick and they look good and they, you know, they have really great haircuts and expensive suits and whatnot, or they look cool. They act like nobody's questioning them. But people are questioning them because they're losing viewership in droves, okay? People are starting to realize big time that they have been manipulated, that they're being lied to, that, you know, their tax dollars are used for investigations that are actually cover up. So it's starting to crack. It's starting to happen. But as I said, you know, 9/11 is the biggest nut to crack because so much horrific stuff has flowed from it. And I've always said this about the press, you know, they always talk about after 9/11 this happened, after 9/11 that happened. And I just feel like screaming, why do you keep talking about after 9/11? If after 9/11 has been so bad, don't you think it's worth taking a second look at 9/11? You know, but again, there's that pathology that I just described to you in two instances. And I was shocked when it happened on my show because I hadn't experienced it in a long time. That's what you're up against.
That is such a good point. They talk about after 9/11, the post 9/11 world. It's like this timeline changing event that's had so much of an impact on the entire world that just heightens the importance of reinvestigating it. I mean, there are disasters that happened, I don't know, 100 years ago, 200 years ago, that maybe doesn't have any controversy surrounding the official story. They will research those things in finest details just to have a historical understanding. But you've got this thing where they say, well, it was looked into by these agencies and there's nothing else to talk about. We'll talk about why we need to do these new steps to prevent it from happening again, supposedly, but we will not talk about why did these buildings actually come down.
Yes, and the interesting thing is that the new steps, that's exactly what happened with TWA. Oh, yes. It was a mechanical malfunction. It was a spark in the fuel tank that brought down TWA Flight 800. They didn't retrofit or do anything for years, okay? So obviously they weren't that concerned about it because they knew that wasn't the reason it happened. So if you're going to fix things so they don't happen again, that's not what you're going to have to do, okay? You're going to have to not have missiles flying around off the, you know, heavily populated littoral area of New York. In the case of 9/11, you're going to have to do a hell of a lot more. I mean, because I'll tell you, the forensic evidence of explosives alone means that there was prepping going on before those buildings came down. Like just talking about Manhattan. So that has to be investigated. Can't fix that or hold anybody accountable until you figure out who did it. Because the forensic evidence is there. And that's what I was telling James Stewart when he was freaking out when I was talking about the forensic evidence regarding the DNC hack that Bill Binney and the Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, his team who looked at the forensic, I said, if there's an investigation and something like an explosion or whatever happens, you have to look at the forensic evidence first. Not what this one says or that one says. You have to look at the evidence, and the evidence will tell you, you know, that's where the ball of string begins. And when you pull that ball of string, that forensic evidence will lead you to the people or the agencies or the whatevers. You don't start with a theory. You don't start with a theory and, you know, I mean, how long did it take them to say, oh, yes, it was a bunch of, you know, Middle Eastern pilots or whatever? It took them, like, barely a few hours, you know, which that alone was so suspicious. It was incredibly suspicious, and of course it goes from there. James Corbett, you know James Corbett?
Oh, absolutely. He's been on the show.
Okay, so James, everybody should post this. I'm sure you've posted it or played it or whatever. I had James on my show the other day, and that's how I introduced him. I played his, you know, that piece he did where he basically narrates the official narrative.
Right.
And it's just hilarious. It's so, because it's so absurd, you know, it's hilarious at once hilarious and incredibly infuriating, because it's like they didn't even bother to come up with a credible story. And meanwhile, our blood and treasure and lives of millions of people, our civil liberties of people all over the world have been affected by this.
Well, it's also taken a toll on our culture, too. I mean, I noticed this after 9/11, and I always debate with myself whether or not it really changed after 9/11, or if it's just because I grew up more and could see it more. But the culture of debate and discussion on news, and then it leaks out into the general public, is this shouting match. These wedge issues is being put to the forefront as the most important issues facing us right now. Well, things like 9/11, other things like what you're citing with TWA, are pushed to the back, ridiculed as conspiracy theories. I know the nature of discussion and debate has been boiled down to just try to shut down your opponent, don't listen to anything they have to say, any new evidence. You've taken a position now, you must defend it till the very end. And I think this affects how people interact with each other in our culture, too, because, you know, they watch TV, they think this is normal.
Everybody's on edge, and partially because, let's face it, everywhere you go now, when you go on an airplane, okay, when you go to fly somewhere, you are treated like a potential terrorist, period. You're herded like cattle into these lines, and you're this and that, and then you have to be x-rayed and take your shoes off and take your belt off, do all these really kind of humiliating and sort of feel it. You feel that Big Brother power trip that's going on. For what reason? Are you telling me that they don't have a way of figuring out whether or not you're a potential terrorist? Come on. Come on. Come on. You know, they have your ID. The whole thing is to create this headspace. And everybody, you know, and a lot of people, they're trying to make the best of it, or they, oh, well, I don't have anything to hide. I don't mind. I mean, I feel like it's keeping me safer. Oh, really? You think this is what's keeping you safer? I don't think so. What would keep you safer is, you know, we had some sort of spiritual, I swear to God, I don't know what this is going to sound like to your audience, but we need a spiritual transformation. I mean, we can't have leaders who the only thing they want to do is make war to keep this money-making war machine going, and to divide the population so they can control them, and to suck up all the resources of, you know, hardworking men and women. You can hear the sucking sound as we speak of all the resources going into the hands of a few people. I mean, now you have individuals who have, you know, their own space programs, while we have people who are starving in this world. And this is all part of it. You know, the money that is going into the war machine, our money, the lives. I mean, I have a son. My son is in the Marine Corps. You know, but when he went to Afghanistan, I was terrified, and I was going to these. I remember it was funny because I would be going to these, you know, peace conferences and so on, and talking about the line that went on. I mean, I published that book, Feet to the Fire, that was all about interviewing reporters and how they missed the fact that they were being lied to right into this Iraq war and so on. And my son dared me to put a Marine sticker on the back of my car. And I was like, oh, okay, hey, I'll put it on. And, you know, people would see that as I was going out into the parking lot, want to tear my face off, you know. And I realized, like, people are, they're feeling hostile, they're feeling terrified, they're feeling like powerless. Working on things like 9/11, it makes you feel powerless.
I'll tell you what, I've said it on my show. I mean, there's people who watch things going on now who've start researching the history of control within this country, and they say, "What, you know, what do you do? What does the ordinary person do?" Now, one person by themselves, unless they have a lot of money or a lot of resources at their disposal, aren't going to overturn everything overnight. But you can go up to your congressman and ask an uncomfortable question. And if you don't care about the groupies in the room, that's all a lot of these people are. They're just groupies. They'll clap at whatever the guy in the on the stage will say. If you don't care about them, I mean, that's very empowering because they're actually more afraid of you. Same thing with the journalists that you're speaking of, people who are holding a position being repeaters rather than reporters. I wish I could claim credit for that line. I heard somebody else say that at one point, but it's the truth.
You know, I know. A 10-year-old could do that job. You know that? A 10-year-old could do that job.
Well, that's what I want to get into here because, and you're probably the best person to address this, and you've alluded to it a little bit in this interview earlier, but I want to know how this system of control works. I mean, we can do our research on the outside when people on the TV are really just behind that glass box. We see the control happening. We scratch our heads as to wondering how are all these people controlled. We research things like Operation Mockingbird and all of this, but we're not actually there and seeing it for ourselves. So I want to learn from your experience. How do they decide that a certain story is going to be covered, another one isn't, and when government officials, people in the bureaucracies, intelligence, are not happy with a certain thing coming out? I mean, how does that work? How do they put the pressure on beyond what you explained to me?
There are multiple levers of control, okay? Not to mention the fact that there are some journalists who are journalists as well as assets, who are intelligence assets. But what happens when there's a controversy? Well, for example, let's take Gary Webb's story, the CIA involved in drug dealing so they could fund the Contras in Nicaragua. When you go pitch a story, your boss will tell you, "Oh, that's not a story. Nah, that's not a good story." Or, "I don't believe that. I don't think that's true." And if you say, "Well, you know, I have this source," no. So the higher ups in the bureaucratic hierarchy, they know what's what. I mean, the president of CBS News, president of ABC News, they all know where the lines are, okay? And as I explained to you before, the journalists, they absorb that worldview that is created by the official sources. They absorb it for so that they can't imagine it being otherwise. And that's why, you know, when I had that problem with my senior producer when I was working on the, it was called The Cabal, the show that I was working on, this investigative show looking at who did what during the run-up to the Iraq War to sell it. I mean, when it happened, when I spoke, I could just see, like, she just could not handle, she could not absorb what I was telling her. So she just lashed out at me.
I remember, I didn't watch this documentary when it was on TV, but somebody posted it on YouTube and I saw it and I've confirmed that there was no manipulation or hoax here. That in HBO did some kind of documentary on 9/11, not too long after, like within a few years. And a lot of it consisted of on-the-ground footage from people's cameras that morning, telling the story just through their eyes, through their cameras. And there's that famous, at least famous to this community, video of the firefighters on a payphone. One of them says, "I'm okay," you know, and he's talking to a family member. And then an explosion goes off, and they react to it, because it's a very loud explosion. But in this HBO thing, now you think that the purpose, obviously 9/11 is a tragedy, but they want to make it interesting to the audience, and they want to keep people watching and kind of on the edge of their seats, waiting to see what's going to happen next from this supposedly new footage. You think that somebody making this documentary would want to keep those explosions in because that's something that is exciting, not in a good way, but exciting to the audience to keep them wanting to watch and seeing the firefighters react to it. But they cut it right before the explosion. They go to the next clip. And so, you know, these people who tell me, "Oh, no, it's just that the companies just care about the bottom line. There's no control. The only control is that." Well, there's a clear case where you'd have a more exciting scene there But somebody made that decision to take the explosions out of that film.
No, that was definitely on purpose. Listen, they do it on stuff that is much more innocuous than that. I had an experience where I was doing for CNN. I was doing a biography of Andrea Jung. She was Avon's first woman CEO, right? And very, very accomplished woman, very dignified. And she had just opened up a flagship, Avon flagship store in Trump Tower. So I went to film her for the opening, and Trump was there. And so we go up to this room, and Trump gets up to introduce her. And this is what he said. He said, "Andrea Jung, she's brilliant. What a negotiator, a great negotiator. You know, we went back and forth, but she got a really good deal. And she played me like a drum." And then he looks back at her and he goes, "But I bet you've played a lot of men like a drum to get to where you were." And you could hear the audience go, "Oh," like that, right? And so I put that moment in my piece on Andrea Jung because I thought it was very, you know, it was very telling about how she had broken the glass ceiling to get there and still being, you know, she's still being harassed at this point. And the senior producer comes in and says, "Oh, no, you've got to take that out." And I said, "But why?" And she said to me, "Can you say words in your on your show?" She goes, "Well, because you're making him look like an a-hole." And I said, "That's exactly what he did while we were there." "Well, no, that's got to come out. We can't make him look bad." I was like, so that was just a little biography of Andrea Jung, Avon CEO, okay? 9/11, do you now understand how big and impenetrable? And the thing that I think is important is for these groups like the 9/11 pilots, that these people with real hard expertise, you know, like the architects and engineers, the pilots, the people like that, they're the ones who need to confront the reporters. One of the things that started happening, I told you that when we started attacking reporters after our documentary on TWA came out, we started attacking these reporters when they, rebutting, not attacking, but we were rebutting. If they put out false information or misinformation, we rebutted it with the facts and forensic evidence. We backed up everything we said, right? And that's when they started backing off. And it got to the point where we would have conversations, like with the New York Times science reporter, we wanted him to do something on the show. And we were going back and forth. And he finally said to us, "Well, now, the New York Times, let me tell you, had plenty to say when TWA first went down, and they were talking about, first they were talking about evidence of explosives, you know, they wrote all about that, and then all of a sudden it became a mechanical failure, and they never mentioned the explosives evidence again. It was so bizarre. But this science reporter finally said, you know what he said to us? "Well, I can't do anything on this because I don't have the expertise to assess the information in your show." Basically, he was saying, "I can't do this. I can't do this." Not because he could not as a reporter, because if you're a reporter and you don't have the expertise, you're supposed to know where to go to get the expertise.
Exactly.
That is part of your job, okay? But that was his backpedal, okay? He finally had to say, "I don't have the expertise," because what else was he going to say? "I can't do this because I will be discrediting all the reporters that came before me and said, you know, the exact opposite, but didn't back it up with the forensic evidence or with the first-hand sources who actually handled that evidence." So you see the problem. It's massive.
There is a huge problem. It's massive. And, you know, unfortunately, I am enjoying this conversation, but we are at the end of the hour. Folks, this is just a preview of the great conversations and insight from Christina Borgeson. Christina, in our last 40 seconds here, how can our listeners find your show and tune in?
Easiest way to find it is on Podbean. Just go to Google, put in Bob Podbean and the Whistleblower Newsroom, and bang. You'll see all our shows.
There you go. And I'm going to try my best to link it here in the show description for easy access to the audience. But you definitely got to check this out. And I got to have you back on the show so we can pick up this conversation, because this is the kind of stuff that I am very interested in hearing about, all of this great insight and wisdom. So, Christina Borgeson, thank you for all the work that you have done over the years. And thank you so much for coming on 9/11 Freefall today.
My pleasure, my pleasure.
The show is on every Thursday night on No Lies Radio at 10 o'clock Eastern, 7 o'clock Pacific. You can also keep track of the archives by going to 911freefall.com. This is Andy Steele saying have a great week and good luck.